This is Jake Bernstein with ProPublica, and today we are very fortunate to have William D. Cohen, who's crackerjack investigative reporter, who's written a recent magazine article for the Financial Times about Wall Street whistleblowers. Mr. Cohen is also has a new book out, which is called The Price of Silence. It's about the Duke lacrosse scandal. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
It's great to be here, Jake. Thank you for having me.
All right. So I thought the first thing we could start off on is just a little bit about your background. You're sort of this rare hybrid of journalist and former banker.
Yeah, I had started as a journalist, actually as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina. Much to my surprise and pleasure, I latched onto a story early on about I covered public schools in Wake County, North Carolina, and the school superintendent was misusing funds that should have been used for underprivileged kids, and he was using them to set up a magnet school system. So sort of a subtle subterfuge, and then that would have been okay, but then he lied about it all, and that was the end of him. So that's sort of how I began, and then I went to business school trying to get a job at the Wall Street Journal. Couldn't pull that off and went to Wall Street instead, where I worked for 17 years, rising to become a head of media and telecom M&A at J.P. Morgan Chase.
Wow.
And then 10 years ago, literally, I was liberated and went back to journalism.
Well, that's great. It sort of gives you a fascinating perspective. Why did you, for this story, what sort of drew you to looking at Wall Street whistleblowers?
For a long time, I'd been writing columns for the New York Times and then for Bloomberg View when David Shipley went over there to start that. And I found myself drawn to people who had tried to do the right thing on Wall Street and then paid the ultimate price for it. Not that they were killed, but that they were metaphorically killed off.
Yeah.
You know, I kept hearing about these stories, and there are so many out there. And I was also fascinated by knowing what the high mortality rate, to keep that metaphor going, I was just drawn to what made people willing to do it, knowing that the chances are they were going to get fired.
Can you just tell us a little bit about the three and sort of what?
Sure. One was Oliver Boudet, who had worked at Skadden, a law firm, for a while, didn't make partner, then by serendipity found himself in the general counsel's office at Lehman in the years before its blow-up. Right from the get-go, he felt that they were sort of monkeying around with the way they reported in their public filings the compensation that the top executives at Lehman were getting, especially Dick Fuld and the former CEO. And
who insisted that he only made something like $300 million when in fact it was more like
$525 million.
Right.
And he did that in a public forum in front of Congress after Lehman blew up, which made it all the more delicious. This guy, Oliver, kept trying to alert people at Lehman and at outside counsel that this didn't feel right to him and that it really should be changed. There should be more disclosure. This went on for a number of years, and then a few years before Lehman blew up, he just decided, you know what, I can't take this anymore. I mean, I feel like a fraud. I can't really do my job because I know they're doing something wrong, and they won't do anything about it, and I've tried to do something about it, and they're just not listening. So he took his final bonus and then quit the next day. And, of course, his analysis of the amount of compensation that Dick Fuld got, the 525 or whatever, was also verified by Lucien Bebchuk at Harvard Law School, who had done his own analysis. Then the story took a very interesting twist, which was that he went around, sort of traveled the world a little bit and moved back to Vermont, where he had grew up in part, and he saw that the SEC had kind of changed the rules on what the disclosure should be. So he thought for sure Lehman would then have to disclose all that it had been doing. And then he waited for the next 10-K, and it came out, and they hadn't. They hadn't changed their disclosure one iota, and it was still hidden. So that's when he went to the SEC, and he went to all sorts of regulatory bodies, and he thought for sure, and he detailed, I mean, this is detailed stuff, and he thought for sure they would be all over it, leading right up until the days before Lehman's bankruptcy. And they all completely ignored him, didn't do a damn thing. And
I mean, this is one of the interesting things about his story, and I think it's sort of similar to the other stories as well, is that in some ways, it's an indictment that's bigger than just a bank, right? I mean, you've got an outside counsel who signs off on this. You've got prosecutors in the SEC that don't do anything.
Exactly. I mean, stuff we've known about all along. We know that there's a complex of self-fulfilling circle of life, if you will, that keeps all of this going. I mean, you know, Jesse Eisinger wrote that, you know, fabulous piece about the Credit Suisse guy. I mean, the one guy. I mean, and I've always thought there should be like free Fab T-shirts made up for Fabrice Touré. I mean,
who the Goldman executive,
you know, vice president, who was just merely a soldier in the army.
Right.
And I know after my 17 years, I know what that means to be a soldier in the Wall Street Army. For him to be the one that they single out and prosecute publicly is beyond ridiculous. So there does seem to be this, you know, the so-called revolving door that protects this. And then we saw the same thing in Eric Benartzi's story, the Deutsche Bank, a guy who used to work at Goldman, who thought that they had overstated, and a PhD and a very smart guy, the value of these very difficult to value securities that Deutsche Bank had had on its balance sheet. And in fact, this was after the financial crisis. Had they been valued correctly, he believed, Deutsche Bank would have needed a bailout.
Right.
You know, and it just shows you how ephemeral are the accounting rules that allow, you know, for all sorts of interpretation. Now, we know that because we saw it happen in the 2008 crisis in spades with Bear Stearns and Lehman and Merrill and Morgan Stanley. And here, you know, Deutsche Bank had been sort of holding itself out as a, you know, great survivor of the crisis. And, you know, but he thought that they had mismarked their books, you know, on the order of $10 to $12 billion. And you see now, you know, last week when they announced a big equity raise, that actually he may have been onto something. And anyway, he reported this to the SEC. There's an investigation still going. And of course, he got fired, too.
It's interesting that these folks seem to be largely from the risk or compliance part of the bank. It seems like it's rarely the traders who blow the whistle, right? Is it that these people are already somewhat marginalized within the bank even before they blow the whistle, or?
Well, in part, of course, their job is to look for nail. They're like hammers, and everything looks like a nail to them. So their job is to look for, I mean, Peter Saveri, the third guy, his job literally at J.P. Morgan was to go through compliance. You know, he was a compliance officer, and his job was to go through documents. And his complaint was that he found documents that J.P. Morgan was not turning over to the SEC in response to a subpoena about, you know, late trading of mutual funds. Again, so each of these three guys was in this role. But the a fourth guy who got lost on the cutting room floor was Richard Bowen, sort of the famous guy at Citigroup. And he was a head of the business line.
Right.
Of mortgage finance, or one of the pieces of mortgage finance at Citigroup. And of course, he famously wrote emails to Bob Rubin, the chairman of Citigroup at that time, trying to get his attention to focus on this. And it all just fell on deaf ears. So, and I would say Eric Benartzi was not so much in the compliance part as sort of, you know, his job was to make sure that everything was valued properly. And,
right.
And his experience at Goldman had That's another thing which, you know, and I've written about this, you know, in my Golden book and in other places, that Goldman, unlike every other firm on Wall Street, which compliance people and regulatory people inside the bank are people to be maneuvered around, which is to your point about why the traders aren't reporting this.
Right.
At Goldman, they actually give these people a lot more status, a lot more authority. They cannot be maneuvered around.
Huh.
And that is why Goldman, generally speaking, has done a better job. For instance, I tell the story in the Goldman book about how this group of relatively low-level traders at Goldman had seen trouble coming in the mortgage market throughout 2006 and then bubbled up this idea that Goldman should be making a big proprietary bet against the mortgage market, which, of course, they did and made a ton of money in 2007, which by 2010 they decided to call a hedge and not a proprietary bet.
Is that just because they're not as siloed in Goldman as they might be in other banks?
Yes, and it's that. And they actually trust and put faith in their junior people. They select them very carefully, as we all know, and they make them feel like they're empowered and that ideas can bubble up from bottom to top. Where at other banks, the junior people are on the line of production and can't possibly have an independent, intelligent thought.
I mean, because what's fascinating to me is that these banks all have systems in place where they're supposed to catch all this stuff. It's supposed to get to the people that are that make decisions, and it's all supposed to be, at least within the bank, transparent. But all that seems to get subverted again and again and again.
Because the price to be paid for actually self-reporting or finding something and doing something about it is so high. I mean, if Deutsche Bank had actually, now they say they reported this to the SEC in 2010, you know, what Eric Bernardsi reported it himself before being fired. His story makes clear that Deutsche Bank had no interest in really getting to the bottom of what he was doing, because it would have meant that they would have to restate their financial statements and show that their capital account would be literally virtually wiped out, and they would need a bailout and on the verge of failing and would have started a run on the bank. So you can see, of course, they wouldn't do that. You know, in the case of Peter Saveri, who found these documents related to the late trading of mutual funds that were responsive to an SEC investigation, you know, that seems relatively minor in the scheme of things, you know, compared to the collapse of the bank, but would have, you know, were terribly embarrassing to J.P. Morgan. And so, you know, he had to be fired.
And what's interesting is that some of these things, if not judgment calls, I mean, there's a chance that it'll all work out, right? The economy goes up and they can sort of smooth it through. So it's really, you know, these calls, you know, 9 times out of 10, it might be okay. It's that 10th time that if you sort of push this all to the side.
I'm not so sure. I mean, it's okay as much as, well, we'll just say no, you know, or we'll just disagree. One of my favorite lines is how Eric Bernardsi was told, "What makes you think you're smarter than all the other people at Deutsche Bank, you know, who've looked at this and decided that there's nothing there and that everything's fine?" I mean, it's just such a classic sense of arrogance that these institutions feel, or that they go into immediate overdrive to protect themselves so that, you know, somebody like this cannot raise any questions about how the organization works. And, you know, Deutsche Bank is, of course, a classic for the revolving door. I mean, I think the general counsels at Deutsche Bank in the Americas have been revolving through the Department of Enforcement at the SEC for years and years and years.
Well, and this guy's boss actually ends up at the SEC.
And right? This guy's, the guy who was like telling him to behave, Robert Rice, is now general counsel to the chairman of the SEC.
Right.
One of a long line. You know, Richard Walker, who is currently the general counsel of Deutsche Bank, used to be the SEC enforcement head. Robert Kuzami, who was general counsel of Deutsche Bank in the Americas, head of enforcement at the SEC, now $5 million a year man at a law firm. Clearly, this cabal of self-protection is causing real problems, I think. It's not making the system any safer.
Right. Although, ostensibly, Dodd-Frank is supposed to take care of all of this, right? They've created sort of ways for whistleblowers to safely blow the whistle, and it's all okay now, although your article seems to suggest that that's not, in fact, the case.
Well, I think the jury is very much still out on that. Obviously, Dodd-Frank, one of the things that I think it might actually have done right is to provide protection for whistleblowers. So we have seen recently as this week, a whistleblower award of small amount of like whatever it was, $800,000 or whatever, split by these two people. We don't know who they are. We don't know what the institution is. The famous $14 million award from last year, we don't know who it went to, although the journal has speculated, and we don't know what institution. The point that some people made in the article was that, what is this really doing? Is this hush money? Yes, it's protecting the whistleblowers, but we don't really know the institution, that what they did wrong and what this money went for. And so is it just, you know, again, a very clever tactic to keep these institutions from really getting the accountability that they need?
And we don't even really know if it's truly protecting the whistleblower, right? I mean, because there could be retaliation if their bosses figure out that's the person.
That's right. We don't truly know, although I suspect if the person who got the $14 million award was suddenly fired, we probably would hear about it some way. Somebody would hear about it. But, you know, one of the nice things about the whistleblowers coming forward and risking their jobs and in each case, you know, getting fired or leaving is that you do become aware quite acutely of what it is that they believe was wrong. And then, you know, there's really quite a lot of detail behind all of that.
Right.
And it's a rich treasure trove, and it's amazingly revealing. It seems to me there's very little question in each case that the whistleblowers were right. And you can see it in the antics of the banks trying to get rid of them or cover it up or pretend it doesn't exist.
Well, it's interesting because there's some common characteristics to these whistleblowers, and it might just be all whistleblowers, or it might be sort of whistleblowers on Wall Street, but there's that sense of certainty. You know, they know their area, and they feel like they're correct in their judgments.
And there's evidence that they produce.
And there's also sort of a lack of cynicism that is surprising, particularly when dealing with Wall Street, right? I mean, they really believe that it's an important to do the right thing.
Which makes that last quote in the article from Peter Saveri so poignant, where he talks about what he had learned and, you know, he wished he had known about the revolving door. He'd wish he'd known how in the pocket of Wall Street, you know, outside lawyers are. He wish he had known that general counsels would do whatever it is they needed to do to make all these things go away. He wish he hadn't been so naive. I mean, it was, you know, I totally get that. And, you know, Wall Street's a bit of a fantasy land in that you work there. You believe going in that if you just work hard and do a good job, you'll be rewarded. And I think that happens a lot of time. And then you're rewarded in ways that you can't even imagine. I mean, making so much more than you ever thought possible. I remember thinking, you know, I could be a journalist in Raleigh, you know, for the rest of my life and not make as much money as I did in 1 year on Wall Street. And then it just keeps getting more and more and more. And basically everybody on Wall Street is probably the most risk-averse culture on the face of the earth because, and I know that's a little counterintuitive, but because nobody there is risking their own capital. They are all working with other people's money, and they are getting rewarded as if they were taking bets with their own money. So they're getting paid, many cases, millions of dollars. They're not risking any of their own capital. As we all saw in 2008, if anything goes wrong, it comes out of our hide. So you've got this incredible cohort of risk-averse people getting paid a lot of money, and they almost can't believe their good fortune. And so, you know, when they stumble across something that doesn't look right, I think they probably believe that, well, the bank will do the right thing because look what it's doing. It's paying us all this money. But really what is happening is they're paying you for your cooperation.
Right. Your adherence to the culture.
Your adherence to the culture and not being a nail that needs to be hammered down. And they're also paying you, I like to say, your bonus is really the present value of your future pink slip because you're really going to, you know, very few people get out alive. I mean, you are, whether you're a whistleblower or not,
you'll be spit out.
Yeah. At one point, you're going to be spit out. There's no question, unless you're going to the very top.
But these guys, I mean, even though they're brutalized after blowing the whistle, it seems like they all feel like they didn't really have a choice. I mean, that they had to do it, that they were compelled to do it.
And that's what makes their stories so remarkable and them so remarkable as human beings. I mean, I have to say, I've gotten to know them and I have incredible admiration for them. It's really gutsy, and it's hard to make this decision. And it's clear that they thought they were doing the right thing. Dick Bowen was forced out of Citigroup. He's now a professor in Texas of accounting. You know, doesn't nearly make what he did before. Eric Benartzi is now a professor at Ohio State. Doesn't nearly make what he was making before. Oliver Boudet is doing a little law on the side, writing a book. Same thing. Peter Saveri, I mean, and there's a lot more to Peter's story than I was able to get in, and I've written about it elsewhere. His story is actually incredible. One of the things he did is he reported it to the SEC, and then he actually had a conversation with a lawyer at the SEC who ratted him out to J.P. Morgan.
Wow.
And incredibly, that lawyer is now running for Congress from Long Island. And so here's this guy who, you know, violated the single most important piece of trust between the regulator and a whistleblower. He ratted him out. And then he thinks nothing of running for Congress. This is his second time to run for Congress from Long Island. He lost the first time 2 years ago, and now he's running again.
That's extraordinary.
Only in America.
These whistleblowers have violated a code of omerta that's sort of Wall Street-wide. Are they blackballed in the industry in some way for this? I mean, is the sense that banks are paying attention and communicate?
Yes. Yes. And you could see it. Peter Saveri was blackballed, but he was able to overcome it, I think, in an extraordinary fashion. I mean, you could see in his U-5, which is, of course, the central document that follows you around. It's like a rap sheet that follows you around from every place that you work. It's a very important document that is filed with like FINRA and the regulators. And when you leave a place, they put on there why you left. And in Peter's case, he had negotiated, he and his lawyer, especially after OSHA found that he should be reinstated and they settled, a very clear message about why he had left J.P. Morgan on the U-5, which, of course, can be immediately looked at by any prospective employer. And J.P. Morgan violated that and wrote something that he made Peter Severi look like, you know, a horrible person. And then he fought to have them change it to what they had agreed to. And he won that, too. Yeah, so they, of course, I mean, you know, and my own experience is, frankly, evocative of that as well. I mean, I wasn't a whistleblower, but, you know, I was terminated from my job at J.P. Morgan in January of 2004 as part of a wave of layoffs. And I had the temerity not to go quietly. And I filed an arbitration suit against J.P. Morgan, which, of course, I lost, like many people do. And, you know, basically was blackballed in the industry as a result of that, which was, you know, fine with me because I was had enough at that point anyway after 17 years and was happy to go be a writer. But, that, you know, that is the way the industry works.
Right. Right.
And in fact, you know, when you join the industry or when you are a broker, you have a brokerage relationship with the industry, in all that fine print that you sign when you first, you know, in the euphoria of getting a job or the euphoria of opening a brokerage account in Merrill Lynch, you know, what you're signing away, basically, which you don't even realize it, is a very basic legal right to use the court system to adjudicate any conflict, a financial conflict that you have with Wall Street. You are agreeing right from the outset to go into a FINRA-style arbitration, which is an incredible abdication of legal rights that most people don't even have a clue about. And then when they do figure it out, it's too late because they've got a beef with Wall Street and they have to go to FINRA arbitration. And who controls FINRA? FINRA is controlled by Wall Street.
Right. And this all goes back to the secrecy aspect of it.
The omerta, your word, a great word.
And it's so, I mean, the fact that the regulators in some ways co-sign this, that they agree to help keep all this stuff under wraps, is really troubling because change is never going to happen in the culture unless it's sort of dragged out into the light.
It is an omerta. It's a symbiotic relationship. I mean, look, I mean, if you want to even be a little bit cynical about the new whistleblower protections in Dodd-Frank, it's all to keep it quiet.
Right.
We'll give you the money. Your name will never be known, which is probably a good thing so that they can not lose their jobs. But then we don't have to reveal what you found out. And we don't have to reveal what institution it was that, you know, you found it out at.
And then even when we do find out, the consequences are so limited. I mean, I'm still sort of stupefied, and I think most people are, why there were no consequences really for Dick Fuld or, you know, or
Jimmy
out of
Kane or Stan O'Neill or the guy at Mozilla. I mean, in fact, there was less than no consequences. They walked off with hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yes.
What's the message being broadcast loud and clear to all of us? You'll be bailed out. You'll be rewarded. And then in this part of the bailout, of course, we all know, was billions of dollars of bonuses for bankers in 2008, 2009. I mean, you know.
Right. So do you think these banks have become sort of too big to manage or too big to regulate?
Well, no, I don't think they're too big to regulate if people will actually regulate them. I think that they are clearly too big to fail. I mean, there's clearly they're too big to jail, too big to fail. They're too big to wind down. I mean, there's no winding down. I mean, they can talk about wind down authority all they want. There's no way. Just like, you know, in France, there's, you know, you can see with, you know, the French trying to, you know, intervene with any fine that's levied against
over
BNP.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, France has national champions. Guess what? We don't call them this anymore, but the U.S. has national champions when it comes to the banking sector, too. And there's no way these firms are. I mean, if you're not going to let Citigroup fail in November of 2008 and you're going to basically prop it up with $350 billion of rescue financing, then you're not going to let any of these banks fail. And I believe that there actually something good could come from letting these banks fail because they're financially and morally bankrupt and they should therefore not be allowed to exist in a capitalist system.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Bill. Again, it's William D. Cohen, who's a gifted author and an investigative reporter. And I encourage you all to check out his work. Thank you.
Thank you, Jake, for having me.